relativity again. And let's see. So what I just want to recap what we did yesterday. So yesterday we did a very simple experiment. We had Alice at rest in still air. And we had Bob moving past her like this. And remember, as soon as Bob moves past her, she starts her watch going. She waits for a certain time, T. She claps her hands. A sound signal goes chasing after Bob. And it reaches Bob. And then Bob claps his hands, sends a sound signal back to Alice. And we came up with this picture here. So here is Alice. Alice is at rest with respect to the air. Okay, and so her world line is just vertical like that. Okay, and remember, we're plotting the speed of sound c times time for Alice. And what's Bob doing? Well, Bob is drifting across her frame as time goes on. So his world line, he crosses her path over here, and his world line goes up like this. And so this is Bob's time axis. His clock is ticking, tick 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on his clock, okay, as he's floating across her space. And just to, as a reference here, at 45 degrees, what's at 45 degrees? So if Alice were to have clapped her hands at the same time that Bob passed her location, then this sound wave would travel faster than Bob and would go, you know, further than him in a given time. Okay, so this is a sound wave. So this is 45 degrees. And here C is the speed of sound. Okay, so we got that. And then as soon as Bob crosses her path, she starts her stopwatch, and she waits a certain time, capital T, on her clock. And then she emits a sound wave. She claps her hands. So because we're plotting C times T, we put CT here. Okay, and then that sound signal goes out at 45 degrees, like this. It catches up with Bob. And then he claps his hands, and he sends the sound signal back like that. And the important thing here is that this is 45 degrees, obviously, because Alice is at rest with respect to the air. And any sound that she emits, she is going to observe it to be moving at the speed of sound. But this one here is also at 45 degrees. And this is the important one. This is also at 45 degrees, even though Bob is a moving source. Bob is drifting with respect to the air. He claps his hands. But as soon as he claps his hands, he sets up a disturbance in the still air. And then that sound radiates outwards with respect to the still air. And so it moves through the still air at a speed c back to Alice, who is at rest with respect to the still air. And so she sees that sound wave coming at her with a speed c. So it's also 45 degrees. And that's crucial here. So all right, so we got that. And also, we put a couple of other things in the picture. We labeled Bob's velocity v. He's drifting with a speed v to the right. And we suppose that the instant Bob receives her sound signal, the instant he hears Alice's clap, we suppose that he has traveled a distance d in Alice's space. So he started at Alice's location, and he drifts, do, 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 do. When he hears the clap, he's a distance d away from Alice. Okay, and then the beautiful thing about plotting ct versus x instead of t versus x is these are 45s. And so if that's d, then what's that? D, and that's also d. Okay, so actually, let's put this down here. Ct is that guy there. Okay, so that's our picture there. And from that picture, what we did is, actually, let me just put the word subluminal, subsonic here. Okay, so Bob is moving at subsonic speeds, so slower than the speed of sound. Okay, so so that's that. And the most important thing on this picture is this time here. Okay, so we're wondering how much time has elapsed for Bob. Okay, so what we do know is that time must be proportional to CT. So we talked about that as well. So if this, so we said it was K times CT. That's the number of tick marks on here representing the ticking of Bob's clock. Okay, and the reason for that is remember, if we were to double this time, say make it this big, then we would also double this time. Okay, so whatever this time is, that's our unknown, it must be just proportional to that time over there. Okay, so that diagram there makes no assumptions whatsoever. Okay, it's super basic physics. It's just Alice in at rest in air, Bob drifting through, and everything. It's very, very simple physics. Okay, so and then what we did is we said, okay, well let's try to figure out what this k is, because that's the really important thing. Because if we know what that k is, then we know how much time elapses for Bob when a certain amount of time elapses for Alice. One way to determine k is to simply assume that when 1 second elapses for Alice, 1 second elapses for Bob, and 1 second elapses for everyone in the universe, that there's such a thing as absolute or universal time. And 1 second elapses for one person, 1 second elapses for anyone, regardless of their state of motion. In which case, we just said, oh, well, that means that this time here, d plus ct, must equal that, kct, and then we solved for k. And then we found that, in fact, k is just the ordinary Doppler shift per sound in air. Okay. What we're going to do now is we're going to drop that assumption about universal time and find a different way of calculating k, a more natural way of calculating k. And we'll find that k is not what we got before. It's something different. And it tells us that the amount of time elapsed for Bob from here to here is not the same as the amount of time elapsed for Alice from here to here. Universal time does not exist. Okay? And time is different for everybody. Everybody has their own sense of time. Okay, so that's the goal here. Okay, so to reach that goal, what we're going to do is we're going to take this picture here, which works for sound in air, and we're going to imagine that instead of Alice and Bob exchanging sound signals in air at rest, we're going to imagine that they're exchanging light signals. Okay, so the speed of sound is going to become the speed of light, and subsonic is going to become subluminal and all that stuff. So we're just replacing sound with light. Okay, so the first step here is just to sort of we have a concrete picture of what's going on, and to make the picture as close as possible to what we had for sound, what we're going to do is we're going to imagine that light is a wave in ether. So how many of you know about the concept of ether, have heard about the concept of, how many of you have not heard ether before, the word ether? Okay, so about a third of you. Okay, so it turns out that that in the early 1800s, there were experiments done which showed that light is a wave phenomenon. Okay? And so it exhibits wave properties like diffraction, interference, that kind of stuff. So everyone thought, yeah, okay, light is a wave. Great, fantastic. Okay? So then they looked at other waves. They looked at water waves, and they noticed, well, what is a water wave? A water wave is a disturbance of some medium. Okay, so the water molecules, when you splash in the water molecules are going up and down like this. Okay, so there's something waving. In the case of water waves, it's the water molecules that are waving. Okay, they also knew that sound is just vibrations of some other medium, air. Okay, and so when you talk and sound comes out, it just means that air molecules are vibrating up and down. Okay, so the air molecules are waving back and forth. So then they thought, well, okay, well, light is a wave. So what's waving? And they thought, what's waving? Well, I don't know. Can't really see anything waving. Okay? And so they invented this medium called the ether. And they imagined that the ether is this sort of elastic medium, like air or like water, that pervades all of the universe, fills all of space. And that light is just a wave in this ether. So when I click on a flashlight, what it does is, imagine this ether as like jelly. Okay, whole, you know, jelly filling the whole universe. If I jiggle the jelly over here, then it will jiggle the neighboring jelly, which will jiggle the neighboring jelly, and so on. And like dominoes, you get a wave going out. So they imagined that light is a waving of this sort of elastic medium they called the ether. Okay, so let's go with that model of light. Okay, because that model of light was actually what was used for all of the 1800s until the beginning of the 1900s. Okay, so let's suppose that light is a wave in ether for a moment. And we'll put a question mark there, okay? Because it actually will show that it's not that. But so light is a wave in ether, and that's exactly analogous to sound being a wave in air. Okay, so what we're doing is we're going to take this picture here, and in the backdrop of this picture, we have in mind still air. So now in the backdrop of this picture, we're going to have in mind ether. Okay? And Alice is at rest with respect to this mysterious medium called the ether. And she is, instead of clapping her hands and sending a sound signal, she's sending light signals. Okay? The point is that this situation here, light as a wave in ether, is completely analogous, 100% the same as sound as a wave in air. And so we can take this diagram and use exactly the same draw exactly the same picture for an experiment in which Bob is drifting through her frame, Alice waits a time t, clicks on her laser, and sends that laser light over here, and Bob has a mirror which reflects that laser light back. And the important thing is when he reflects it back, the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source. So in this case, Bob is drifting through that mysterious ether medium. But when he clicks on his flashlight or laser or sends it back with the mirror, that light travels with respect to the still ether with a speed c, which is now the speed of light. Okay? And so Alice will measure that speed to be c, independent of the motion of Bob, independent of how fast he's moving either away or toward her. So this becomes, c becomes the speed of light. And this becomes, Bob is moving not subsonic, but subluminal. Okay, and something moving superluminal would be like that, faster than the speed of light. Okay, so that's our picture. We just carry it over in its entirety without any change. Okay, so so Einstein, let's now switch to talking a little bit about Einstein and the theory of special relativity. So Einstein based his theory of special relativity on two principles. And one of those principles has to do with the speed of light. Can anyone tell me what that principle states?
Yeah.
Me?
Yeah.
You state that the speed of light is the same constant speed relative to anybody.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
The speed of light is the same in every reference.
Okay. Okay, so that's the general consensus of what Einstein said, is that somehow the speed of light is this universal constant, the same for everybody, the same in any reference frame, the same, blah, blah, blah. That's actually not what Einstein said. Okay, so this is a very important point that I want to make here. What Einstein actually said was this. Okay, so there are two principles, principle one and two. We'll start with principle two, which is the speed of light principle. Okay, so understanding this principle properly will really help you to understand the logic of special relativity, why it makes sense, why it's totally believable, why it's the most natural thing you could imagine, or the most natural way the universe could be. Okay, so let me actually read what Einstein said. And before I read that, I have to, before I read the principle, I need to read what he said a little bit earlier to define some terminology. Okay, so this is from his 1905 paper on special relativity. He says, let us take a system of coordinates in which the equations of Newtonian mechanics hold good. In order to render our presentation more precise and to distinguish this system of coordinates verbally from others, which will be introduced hereafter, we call it the stationary system. Okay, so what he's introducing is a reference frame, a coordinate system. Okay, so Alice in some state of motion. Okay, and such that the laws of Newtonian mechanics hold good, which means F equals ma and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so and when you throw something like this and there's no forces acting on it, it moves in a straight line and all that kind of stuff. So he's saying, suppose there exists such a frame. Okay, we will call and then we're going to do all kinds of stuff with that frame. But let's suppose there exists such a frame. Let's call that frame the stationary frame. Okay? And then he states his principle, the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light, which reads, any ray of light moves in the stationary system of coordinates with the determined velocity c, whether the ray be emitted by a stationary or by a moving body. Okay, so let me just paraphrase that. So combining what I just said, I'm going to write it this way, and then we'll talk about it. Okay, so for an observer at rest, the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the source. Okay, so that's what Einstein said. So let's have a look at this. So first of all, at rest, for an observer at rest, well, we know that there's no such thing as absolute rest. Okay, that's one of the ideas. We can anticipate what's coming. We know there's no such thing as absolute rest. There's no such thing as absolute space and all that. That's what we're going to get to. Okay, so when we say an observer at rest, we put it in quotation marks, indicating that really what we mean is what Einstein is saying here. There exists at least one frame of reference in which it is true that Newtonian mechanics holds good. Okay, if I throw an object and there's no forces acting on it, it will move in a straight line. There exists at least one frame in which that's the case. So this is the frame that Einstein calls the stationary frame. Okay, so I'll just say this thing. So there exists at least one frame in which this is true, in which the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the source. Okay, so at the time, this is 1905, people had in mind that most physicists thought that light is a wave in ether. Okay, so is this principle true for if light is a wave in ether? Why? Someone tell me why.
It's like the sound wave we were talking.
Yeah. It's exactly the same as the sound waves in still air. Okay, for sound waves it moving around in still air, if you're at rest with respect to the air, it doesn't matter how the source is moving around. If there's an ambulance coming toward you or moving away from you, the speed of sound will be the same. You will hear a Doppler shift, sure. When it's coming toward you, the frequency goes up. When it's drifting away from you, the frequency is lower. But the speed of that sound wave is always c with respect to the still air. And if you're at rest with respect to that still air, you will always measure that same speed c. Okay? And if light is a wave in ether, exactly the same thing applies. Okay? And so this principle is obviously true if light is a wave in ether phenomenon. Okay? So what I want to So let's just leave it at that. So what I want to emphasize here is that this principle, it would have been completely obvious to anyone in 1905. Okay, there's nothing surprising about it. There's nothing radical about this principle. Everyone would have read that and said, "Yeah, okay, that's obvious. So what?" Okay, so let me just emphasize, because it's very important that we see why it's obvious. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of reasons why it's obvious. One is this: the people at the time had in mind a particular model of light. Okay, they didn't actually know. Well, this is what they thought light is. The fact is, we still don't know what light is exactly. Okay, we don't, because you think about string theory. Well, maybe light is these little strings and so on and so forth. Okay, we still don't actually know what light is at a really fundamental level. We understand light a lot better now than we did back then, but we still really don't know what it is. So at that time, people had this wave in ether model, this mechanical model of light. That light is this mechanical phenomenon that's a physical vibration of some medium called the ether. Just like sound is a mechanical phenomenon, it's a vibration of some physical medium. So they had this mechanical wave in ether model. The wave in ether model of light, just like sound and air, predicts that this is true. Okay, so everyone would have said, yeah, that's obvious. Way to go, Einstein. The second reason is people were aware also that light is an electromagnetic phenomenon. So Maxwell in the 1860s had come up with Maxwell's equations, which describe how electric and magnetic fields are unified, are just different sides of the same coin, how they work together, how one oscillates and then the other oscillates and so on, how they work together to produce an electromagnetic wave. Which moves through space and carries energy and momentum and all that kind of stuff. And it was known that light is an example of an electromagnetic phenomenon. So light is electromagnetic waves of a certain wavelength or a certain frequency range. Okay, so the second thing people would have known at that time is that Maxwell's equations, which describe light, which are the mathematical embodiment of how light behaves, Maxwell's equations also predict this. Okay, so I should elaborate a little bit on that. So what Maxwell's equations say, wow, is that an S? Okay, so what Maxwell's equations say is that, at least classically, non-quantum mechanically, classically, the source of all light is accelerated electric charge. Okay, so what does that mean? So that means if I take a charge like this, a charge at rest will not emit light. A charge in uniform motion will not emit light. But a charge that's accelerated, if I take that charge and jiggle it back and forth, then it will emit electromagnetic waves, which is a form of light. Okay. Right, so let me put it this way. So suppose that you are out in space, floating out in space on some platform here, and you see some charge out here, and this charge is moving around in some completely random way, like this. What's going to happen is that charge, which is accelerating, okay, it's changing its velocity, is going to be emitting electromagnetic waves. And those waves will come at you, and independent of the motion of this thing, if it's accelerating, it's going to emit electromagnetic waves, and you will see the speed of those waves to be c. Okay? If I were to take this same charge, this charge that's wiggling around here, and I were to give it an extra drift, okay, to the right, for example, or to the left, okay, so take this whole pattern of jiggling around and add sort of a drift to the right. Okay? Well, Maxwell's equations would say it's still just a charge wiggling around. Independent of the motion of that source, the speed of the waves you're going to measure is c. Okay, so everyone would have looked at that and said, okay, yep, that's right, Albert. And also, there would have been experimental evidence available at this time through astronomical observations. Okay, so it turns out that, so I don't want to get into this, but it turns out that there's very, very simple observations that you can make of binary star systems. So most, the majority of stars in the galaxy are actually binary pairs, so two stars orbiting around each other. So there's plenty of examples of this. And if you look with a telescope, you will, and you study the motion of these guys, you will also conclude that that the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source in that case being either star. So at one time, the star is moving toward you, at another time, it's moving away from you, and so on. So simple observations, which I don't want to get into, give you strong experimental evidence that the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source. Okay, so everyone would have believed this. Everyone would have said, yep, totally obvious. I want you to compare this statement that I wrote down here with a seemingly, with a closely related statement, but totally different statement. And that is, and let's call it P2 prime. Okay, so this is what Einstein did not say. Okay, if we were to take this statement and we were to replace the word observer here with source, and replace the word source with observer, so just interchange those two words. Okay, so it's exactly the same statement. For a source at rest, the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the observer. Okay. So that seems like a simple switch around, right? No big deal. But if we think about it for a minute, it is a big deal. This is a totally bizarre statement. Okay, so for a source at rest, the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the observer. So that's like saying, suppose I have a flashlight here, which is at rest. It's a source of light, which is shining a beam this way. And that it would be telling me that the speed of light is independent of the motion of the observer. Okay, so suppose we've got this beam of light coming toward me, and I'm at rest with respect to that source, to that flashlight. So I'm, how do I measure the speed of light? Well, what I do is I take a meter stick like this. I time how long it takes a light wavefront to cross from one end of the stick to the other end. I time how long it takes, and I divide, and I get the speed of light. Okay? And I would find, you know, 3 times 10 to the 8 or whatever. Now, this is saying that I would get the same value for the speed of light even if I were running toward that light, which is completely bizarre. I mean, if light is a wave in ether, okay, it's moving at some speed, c, with respect to that still ether. If I now start moving with respect to that ether, moving toward that light with a speed v, what speed should I measure for the speed of light? C plus v. If I'm running away from the flashlight, what speed am I going to measure? C minus v, right? So what if light instead is particles? Suppose we have particles coming out of this flashlight with some speed c, drifting through empty space. Okay, so if I'm at rest with respect to the flashlight, I see them whipping by me with a speed c. If I'm running toward those particles with a speed v, I'm going to measure. If I'm running away, okay, so it's totally bizarre, right? So this statement makes no sense. This statement is completely unbelievable. Okay, so just wanted to point that out. Okay, so this is totally bizarre. P2 prime, totally bizarre. Okay, so at the end of the day, what we're gonna show is that P2 prime actually follows from this and the relativity principle. And the goal of special relativity was to try to understand, because this is in fact true, okay, but it's not at all obvious how it could possibly be true. And the goal of special relativity is to understand why this is true. Okay? So that's what we're gonna get to. All right, so in order to get there, we need Einstein's second principle, which is the more important principle, which is the relativity principle. Okay, so let's start over here. So we'll call this principle number one. This is the more important of the two principles, and that's called the relativity principle. Okay, so I'll just write out a paraphrase. Well, actually, I'll read it and then we'll paraphrase it and then we'll talk about it. Okay, so principle of relativity according to Einstein is the laws by which the states of physical systems undergo change are not affected whether these changes of state be referred to one or the other of two systems of coordinates in uniform translatory motion. Okay, so let's paraphrase that to read this. Given any two inertial observers in uniform relative motion, both are equally entitled to consider themselves to be at rest. Okay? So let me just read the whole thing. So given any two inertial observers in uniform relative motion, both are equally entitled to consider themselves to be at rest. Okay, so the word inertial here, the word inertial means that the observers are not experiencing any acceleration. Okay, so they're floating through empty space and they have their jetpacks or their rocket engines or whatever off, turned off. So they're not accelerating in any way. So this is not accelerating or rotating relative to the distant stars. That's a very deep statement there, but we won't actually fall into that black hole. Okay, so not accelerating or rotating. And they are in uniform relative motion. So what Einstein has in mind here is just two observers floating out in the middle of empty space, just drifting there and in some state of motion. And when one looks at the other, they say, you're going, say, that way with a speed v. This one looks at that one and says, no, you're going that way with a speed v, minus v. Okay? So they're drifting apart or toward each other, whatever, in some uniform relative motion. Both are equally entitled to consider themselves to be at rest. And at rest here is put in quotation marks, meaning the same sort of thing as at rest over here. Okay, so we're going to tie these two together with that word, with that phrase, at rest. Okay, so let me give you an example of this. So suppose that you are in a train car, and this train car has all the shades down, and the train car is at rest on the tracks. And you're inside, so you're just basically inside a room. Okay, and there's a pool table there, game of billiards. How many of you have played pool, billiards? Okay, so basically all of you, okay? So what you're doing is you got the stick, and you're shooting the cue ball around and so on, and you're observing the way these balls behave. Okay, so you observe certain things. You observe stuff like this. So here is one of the banks of the table here. You observe that when you shoot a ball like this toward the bank, if it, say, hits the bank at 45 degrees, it's going to bounce off like this. What's the angle there? 45. Okay. What if you put a spin on it? Suppose you spin it this way and you hit the bank. Is this angle going to be less than or greater than 45? Less. Good. Okay, so that. And suppose that you have a ball like this, and you hit some other ball like this, and then bang like this. So one goes that way, and one goes that way. What can you tell me about this physical phenomenon? Momentum is conserved, right? So you add up the initial momentum, and you find that that's equal to the sum of the momenta of the final momenta of the two balls, et cetera, et cetera, right? So you observe the behavior of these balls reflecting off the sides, equal angles, and all that kind of stuff. And if one ball is spinning one way and you hit a ball at rest, it will transfer some of its spin and everything. So you learn all about the behavior of these balls. Okay? And then after a hard day of playing pool, you go to sleep, you wake up the next morning, and you're at it again. You're playing pool, and you're shooting the balls around and stuff like that. But unbeknownst to you, in the middle of the night, the train, while you were sleeping, the train has taken off. Okay, and now it's whipping down the track at, like, you know, 100 kilometers per hour or something. And we imagine that the track is very smooth and perfectly straight. Okay, and there's basically no vibration, so it's a maglev train or something, you know, that's super smooth. Okay, so you can't feel any vibration, you can't hear the engines going or whatever. The shades are drawn, so you can't see trees whipping by you and so on. And so you just wake up in the morning and whatever, feels the same as before. You play the game of billiards, you know, you shoot a ball like this and you say, oh yes, that angle equals that angle. And when I shoot one ball into the other, I observe, yes, conservation of momentum and all that kind of stuff. And so you observe that the game of billiards plays out exactly the same as it did the previous day. Okay? So the point here is that the velocity of the train, on day one, it was at rest with respect to the tracks. You know, on day two, it's moving with respect to the tracks. The velocity of that train with respect to the tracks has no effect on the way that these balls behave. Okay? In other words, there's no way, by making observations about how the balls behave, that you could get any information about how fast you're going. Okay? That's a very important point. That's basically what this principle of relativity is saying. So I could say it this way. So no way to determine velocity So I'll just say it again slightly differently. What it's saying is that the unaccelerated motion of a system of a room has no effect whatsoever on the way things behave, the way things happen in that room. And that's what it means. Okay, so let's talk about whether this principle is, or this this principle, P1 here, is believable or not. Okay, well, first of all, it's obvious. Certainly in 1905, it would have been completely obvious to anyone if you apply this principle to mechanical phenomena. Okay, and it had been obvious for mechanical phenomena like billiard balls, like soccer balls, like cars, like you know, whatever. It was totally obvious for mechanical phenomena even all the way back to Galileo. So even Galileo knew this. Newton certainly knew this very well, and everyone knows this. Okay, but it's not so obvious for electromagnetic phenomena. So E/M electromagnetic phenomena. Okay, so why is it not obvious for electromagnetic phenomena? Well, at the time, in 1905, so as I said, a lot of physicists had this picture of light as a wave moving in ether, like sound moving in air. So, for example, suppose we go with that. Suppose we imagine that light is the wave in ether, is a wave in ether. And we consider the following simple experiment. Okay, and the same thing would apply for sound in air. Same kind of an experiment. So the blackboard here represents either the ether or the air, depending on whether we're dealing with light or sound. Okay, and so that's sort of this backdrop. So we're going to have things floating around in this ether or this still air. Okay, and the first thing we're going to have floating around is a reference frame like this, which is at rest. So a room which is at rest with respect to that ether or air. And we have a source of light. Let's just stick to light here. Okay, we have a flashlight over here. And what we're going to do is click on this flashlight, and we're going to do a simple experiment. Okay, so we got Alice inside there, and what does she have? She has a ruler, and she has a clock. And she's going to measure the speed of light. Okay, so she clicks on this flashlight. You know, if light is a wave in ether, what that does is it sets up a disturbance of the ether here, and that ether vibrates, and the disturbance moves like dominoes with a speed c relative to the ether. Alice is at rest with respect to the ether. What speed does she measure? C. Okay, so she says, oh yes, c. Okay, now we consider another situation. Okay, so unbeknownst to Alice, in the middle of the night, her little room is accelerated and picks up, is now moving at some velocity, drifting with some velocity v relative to the ether. Okay, so she gets up in the morning and she conducts the same experiment, very complicated experiment. She conducts the same experiment again. Okay, she's got her ruler here and she's got her clock and so on. She does exactly the same experiment. What speed is she going to measure now? Okay, so how many say C? We're assuming wave in ether. Light is a wave in ether. Okay, so just like sound in air. Okay, so don't assume anything about relativity, anything that you know about special relativity. Just go back to the 1800s. Think about light as a wave in ether. And you are moving with respect to that ether. You are drifting this way, and the sound is coming, or the sorry, the light is coming at you this way. What speed are you going to measure? So how many say C? How many say C plus V? Okay, so she's going to measure C plus V. Okay, and let me just reemphasize this. What's going on here? If we imagine that light is a wave in ether, then what is this flashlight doing? What it's doing is it's grabbing a hold of that ether, that mechanical medium, and it's jiggling it around. Every time you set up some kind of a disturbance in that ether, that disturbance moves relative to the still ether. It radiates outwards in all directions relative to the still ether. So as this flash, even though this flashlight is in motion over here with respect to the ether, okay, the waves move at a speed c relative to the still ether. Okay? So here you have waves coming at you, or moving with respect to the still ether with a speed c, but you're drifting in that ether towards those waves. Okay, so you're going to measure c plus v. Okay. So on day one, Alice finds, she does a simple experiment, experiment involving an electromagnetic phenomenon, namely light. Okay, and she finds that, oh yes, the speed of this strange stuff called light is c. Okay, and then she wakes up the next morning, repeats the experiment, and finds a different result. Finds it's now c plus v, and says, whoa, something has changed. And so she can then determine something about the motion of her room based upon observations of a physical phenomenon confined to the inside of that room. Okay? So even though the room is sealed, okay, all the windows are drawn, all the blinds are drawn, she can't see outside, she can't see if she's moving from the day before or not or whatever, she can just conduct a simple experiment that takes place entirely within her little box and determine something about the motion of her box. Okay? So that's completely counter to this relativity principle. Okay? So it was not at all obvious at that time for electromagnetic phenomena. Okay, and that was the problem. Okay, so but what Einstein wanted to do is say, this is such a simple and beautiful principle that we would like to extend that from mechanical phenomena also to electromagnetic phenomena. So Einstein wanted both. In fact, all physical phenomena. Okay, he wanted it to be true that anyone in any inertial motion, non-accelerated motion, can consider themselves to be at rest, exactly as if they're at rest with respect to this ether. Okay, so the results of any experiment don't depend upon your motion. Okay, so everything that happens inside, any physical phenomenon inside a closed box, happens the same way regardless of the motion of that box. You can't determine the motion by doing experiments inside the box, whether those experiments be mechanical or electromagnetic. Okay, the results of all experiments are the same as if you were at rest, in quotation marks. Okay, so the point here is if light is a wave in ether, there's a problem with this principle. It's not obvious that it applies. But what if light is not a wave in ether? Yeah. Yeah.
The one behind.
The invisible one.
So what if we are actually talking about air instead of ether?
Yeah.
So is it possible to say that the air is actually moving with the same velocity we inside the box?
Oh, yeah, so that's a good question. So if we think about this as air, and we are moving with respect to air, then what we are imagining is that that the air can pass through. Okay, so that when this person is moving with respect to the air, the box is not completely sealed. Okay, otherwise the air would be at rest with respect to this person. Right? So we imagine that the person is actually standing on a platform, an open platform like this, and drifting with a velocity v relative to the still air. Okay, and then we would see c plus b.
But how do we know that actually ether would not like move together with the box?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So how would we know that the ether wouldn't just drift along? So here's a massive object like this, and maybe that massive object would grab onto that ether and drag it with it. Okay, so people thought a lot about that sort of thing, and they concluded, well, that can't be happening because, suppose that the ether were some physical substance. Okay, and if that were happening, then here's the sun, and here are planets going around the sun like this, then those planets would also be dragging ether along with them. And if the ether is any kind of a physical substance, that's going to produce a drag. And then the planets would actually slow down and spiral in. And so they made careful measurements of the planets, and they didn't detect any of this spiraling in. Okay, and lots of experiments were done to try to detect, you know, drag and fluids moving and so on and so forth. And it was a very complicated set of ideas floating around. Yeah.
Well, but wouldn't it mean that any movement would
form of light or electromagnetic radiation, since it would set up a certain.
Yeah, that's right. That's right too. So if it were true that material like matter moving through that ether dragged the ether, then my hand would drag the ether as well, and I could just go like this, and I would be setting up vibrations of that ether, and I would be radiating light of low frequency, right? So okay, right. So there are problems with this whole ether idea, with this whole mechanical model of light. Okay, so the question then is, okay, so it's clear that if you have wave and ether in mind, it's clear that there's a problem with principle P1 here. Okay, it's not consistent. But what if light is not a wave and ether? Okay, what if light is not a mechanical vibration of some physical medium? What if light is itself some kind of physical medium in its own right? Okay, so at the same time, in the same year, Einstein wrote a number of very important and influential papers. And one paper that came just before the special relativity paper was his paper that's called the photoelectric effect paper. How many of you are aware of this paper? Okay, so what was the goal of this paper? The goal, right at the beginning of the paper, Einstein states very clearly the goal. The goal is to bring electromagnetic phenomena on the same footing with mechanical phenomena. Okay, so for example, you think about say a baseball. A baseball, I throw a baseball like this. That baseball is moving through space. If I go out into empty space, I can throw a baseball and it can move through a vacuum. Okay, so I can have a chunk of matter moving through a vacuum. And that chunk of matter has various properties. It has energy, it has momentum. If it's spinning, it has angular momentum, all that stuff. So I can have I can have matter moving through a vacuum and having energy, momentum, angular momentum, and all that stuff. What if light is not a vibration of some existing material filling everything? What if light itself is a mechanical phenomenon, like a chunk of matter floating through a vacuum, which has energy, momentum, angular momentum, all that stuff? And in fact, in Maxwell's equations, Maxwell's equations predict that light has momentum, light has energy, light has angular momentum. It has all those properties that ordinary, like a baseball has. Okay, so Einstein said, well, suppose that light is not this sort of thing, this vibration of some physical medium filling all space, but it is a medium of its own self. It is matter. It is like matter. Okay, so he was trying to put electromagnetic phenomena on the same footing as matter at that time. Okay, so then, if that's the case, it is reasonable to try to extend this principle to apply not only to mechanical phenomena but also to light. Okay, so that's the basic point here. So let's say it down here. So it is reasonable to extend principle P1 from applying to just mechanical phenomena also to light, because Einstein was trying to put mechanical phenomena and light on the same footing. Okay, so the immediate problem with that is that if you take the relativity principle and you take Einstein's statement of the constancy of the speed of light, speed of light is independent of the motion of the source, both of these are very believable. Okay, so even if you thought of wave and ether or whatever, this would be obvious to you. Maxwell's equations, this would be obvious to you, etc. And this is also very believable, but something very natural. If you could think of electromagnetic phenomena as physical phenomena in its own right, carrying momentum, angular momentum, and all that, just like a mechanical, baseball floating through space, then it's reasonable to try to extend the relativity principle to include light as well. So these are two believable principles. There are two starting points that everyone in 1905 would have said, yeah, That's reasonable. If you take these two together, they imply this P2 prime. Okay, so I will leave this as an exercise for you to show that logically these two imply this one. Okay, now this one here is totally unbelievable. Remember, this is the one that's saying that if I have a flashlight at rest there, I will measure a speed c for the speed of light, whether I'm running toward the flashlight or away from the flashlight. That makes no sense whatsoever. Okay? But these two are very believable together. So by them in and of themselves, they're not radical at all. But when you combine them together, they predict something totally radical. Okay? And so the point of special relativity is to try to understand how this is believable, how this is natural. Okay, and it required a complete revision of our understanding of what space and time are. Okay, so having said all that, let's get back to this diagram over here, and let's think about how we determine that k. All right, so okay, so remember that when we were dealing with simple sound in air, we determined k just by assuming universal time. So that ct plus d is equal to kct, and that gave us the Doppler shift. Okay, so what now we're going to do is we're going to replace the idea of universal time. We're going to replace that assumption with the relativity principle P1. Okay, so I would much sooner accept something like the relativity principle, which has a real feeling of something universal, a universal truth about our universe, and something very natural, and something that simplifies things. Okay, so I would much rather accept this than accept this sort of ad hoc universal time assumption. Okay, so we're going to drop the universal time assumption and replace it with P1. Okay, and then we're going to determine what k is. And we'll find that k is not the same value that we had before, and we find that Bob's time is not the same as Alice's time. Okay, so how do we do this? So this is actually a very important point that we've reached here. Okay, so if you've been sleeping up till now, now's the time to wake up. Okay, so this is the most important part right here. This is the heart of special relativity. This is all of the logic of special relativity in the next two pictures. Okay, So let's take this picture over here, and let's draw sort of a simplified version of it, just to look at a part of that picture. Okay, so what we've got is Alice at rest. We're taking the point of view that Alice is at rest, so her world line is vertical. So this is Alice at rest. Okay, and what she does is a simple experiment. What she does is, at some time on her clock, when her clock reads zero, what she does is she takes a second clock and she zeroes that clock. She zeroes both clocks at the same time and she throws that clock so that that clock drifts with respect to her with some velocity v. Okay? So previously we had called that Bob. Okay? Or she picks up Bob and throws Bob across the room. Okay? And Bob's got a clock attached. She's not interested in Bob. She's just interested in the clock attached to his wrist. Okay? And so Bob is drifting across the room like this. She waits a time t on her watch, and then she sends a light signal chasing after Bob. Okay, and then and that light signal, when it reaches the clock that Bob has, the clock is designed to freeze, to stop time. Okay, and then what Alice does is afterwards she runs after Bob. She grabs hold of him, looks at his watch, looks at what the frozen time was. She looks at how much time has elapsed on that clock, which she threw across the room. Okay, and according to our picture here, it's going to be whatever time is here, the time here is k times that. OK, Okay, and I'm just dropping the C. We could also put C here. I'm just dropping the C, just to simplify the picture. Okay, it's just to focus on the main point. Okay, so whatever time Alice waits, this time is kt. We don't know what k is. We're trying to figure that out. Okay, so Alice does a simple experiment. She throws a clock with a velocity v, waits a time t. How much time elapses when the clock receives that light signal? Okay, so she does a simple experiment. Okay. Now we're going to apply the relativity principle. So the relativity principle says that for any two observers, any two inertial observers in uniform relative motion. Well, this is certainly true. Imagine Alice and Bob are just floating on the middle of empty space. Okay, from the point of view, taking the point of view that Alice is at rest, she sees Bob drifting to the right with some speed v. But we can also take the point of view of Bob, who just looks at Alice and says, no, I'm at rest, and you're the one who's moving with a speed minus v in the other direction. So given any two inertial observers in uniform relative motion, which certainly applies to Alice and Bob, they're out in the middle of empty space drifting around with a relative velocity v, both are equally entitled to consider themselves to be at rest. Okay, so Alice has done this experiment from the point of view that she is at rest. Okay, now we will allow Bob to do exactly the same experiment with him at rest. So how do I draw Bob's world line? Okay, so Bob's world line is like this. So it's now Bob that we're taking to be at rest. And Alice is moving backwards. Alice is moving this way. Okay, and Bob's going to conduct exactly the same experiment. What he's going to do is, so he's at rest, and Alice is drifting this way, or rather just her clock is drifting this way. So he picks up Alice and he throws her this way with a speed v in the other direction. Okay, and he waits a time t on his clock, and then he sends a light signal chasing after Alice's clock. When Alice's clock receives that light signal, the time freezes, and then Bob comes running after Alice, catches up with her, looks at the time that has elapsed on her clock. Okay, so if there's a time t, what is the time here? Okay, it's also kt. Okay, and it's the same k here. That's important. Okay, so according to the principle of relativity, we've got a situation of two inertial observers in uniform relative motion. They are equally entitled to consider themselves to be at rest. Equally entitled to consider themselves to be at rest. Okay, so the result of they're doing identical experiments, and so the results need to be identical. Okay, they can't actually be able to distinguish who's actually at rest. Is it Bob who's actually at rest, or is it Alice who's actually at rest? Both points of view are equally valid. Okay, and so they're doing the same experiment, so they should get exactly the same result. So this is the same experiment. Okay, so that's it. So is that clear? Are you happy with that? Because if you understand that, then everything follows from this. Okay, so let's see. Let's see what follows from this. So far, does it seem reasonable and natural? Does it seem believable? Okay. Right, so now what we're going to do is we're going to take that picture and we're going to make two modifications to it. The modifications contain no physics whatsoever. Okay, they're just looking at it from a different point of view. Okay, so the first modification we're going to do is so Bob has done an experiment in which Alice is in motion and so on and so forth. We're going to take Bob's experiment and we're going to look at it from Alice's point of view. Okay, so now Alice's world line will be what? Okay, so Alice's world line is vertical like this, okay, and it's Bob who's drifting to the right. Okay, but Bob is the one who's doing the experiment. Bob is the one who waits a time t on his clock and then sends a light signal over to Alice. And how much time has elapsed on Alice's clock when she receives that light signal? Kt. Okay. So we have this picture. So this is, I haven't done anything here. All I've done is I've taken that picture, the information in that picture, which says Bob waits at time t, Alice waits at time kt before receiving that signal. I've just put the t and the kt in the picture that's now drawn from Alice's perspective, Alice being at rest. So I haven't done anything. So this is Bob's experiment. Okay, from the point of view, POV, from the point of view that Alice is at rest. Okay. And now there's only, so are we okay with that? Okay. So now the only other thing that we're going to do is we're going to try to connect this picture with this picture. Okay. So in this picture, we have a T here and a KT here. In this picture, we have a K. See? You'll notice that this triangle here is the same as this triangle here. Okay, so this side is KCT. So we want actually a KCT here instead of just a T. But the fact is that no matter what, the T here is arbitrary. T could be 5 seconds, 5 years, whatever. The point is, whatever appears here, to get what appears here, you just multiply by K. Okay, so we could make T anything we like. Okay, so let's make T. We'll draw the exact same picture, and we will replace t with this thing, k times ct. Or just kt. Let's make it kt, sure. Okay, so if this is kt here, what is this? K squared t. Okay, now in this picture here, I've been plotting ta and tb, okay, just time here. But we know that we want to actually plot C times TA and C times TB, which means we have C's here. Okay? So now this part, this picture here now looks identical to a certain part, a certain subset of this picture, which is this triangle over here. We've got a KCT here. And so okay, so the result of this then is, are we okay so far? All right. Okay, so if we're okay, let me ask you, if I look at this picture, if I compare that picture with that picture, what can I learn about it? What can I learn about the situation? Yes. Okay, so this is k times ct. That's k times ct. This is k squared times ct. So k squared times ct must equal this, which is ct plus d plus t. Okay, so that's crucial. So it tells us that that ct plus d is equal to this thing, k squared times ct. Okay, so we will call this equation 2 prime. Now, if you compare with what we had before, when we made the assumption that of universal time, so we simply assumed that this distance was the same as this, or this amount of time was the same as that amount of time, we got some equation for k. I'll just remind you what that equation was. We called it equation 2. It was ct plus d equals kct. Okay, so this was our equation 2, which was based on universal time. This is based on principle P1. Okay, so notice that there's some similarity here. Ct, but instead of ct plus 2d, we have ct plus d here. Instead of a k squared ct, we have a kct. That's a square, that's not a square. Okay, so there's a difference here. We're going to get a different value of k. Yes, sir?
So, like, are we presuming that in this one first, like,
yep,
time that passes the box
before the time that passes for Alice, isn't that light signal in the other example, far to the left?
Oh.
Like even further.
But this amount of t is arbitrary. Suppose that we've got Bob is drifting past like this. They zero their clocks. Alice waits a time t, sends a signal. If she waits 5 seconds and sends the signal out, and then it stops that clock and so on, and we get some reading, she'll get some value for k or whatever, right?
That one right there.
This one here, okay?
The vertical little, like, that CT bar. Yeah, that. So, like, that's the CT we're using right there, right? And so we're using that time, and we're using that time in the, over there. So are we saying that the same time passes for both observers?
No.
So are those t's different in the
those t's are different. Yeah. Yeah, this the capital T over here refers to the time of Alice that Alice waits. The capital time T refers to the time that Bob waits. And they need not be the same.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so I could have called them different names, but then it would have gotten even messier.
Yeah.
The notation. Yeah, good point. Okay, so so we've had these two equations, and we also had equation one. Does anyone recall equation one? Oops, I don't have it down here. What's equation one? Okay, hang on. What is it? D over CT equals, V over C, 1 minus V over C. Okay? So equation number one is true regardless. Equation one number one is trivial. Okay, there's no physics in it. Okay, equation number two or two prime, here's where all the physics lies. If we assume universal time, we get this. If we assume principle P1, we get that. Okay, so when we combined equation number one with equation number two, we got the non-relativistic Doppler shift. Okay, now we're going to apply combine equation one with two prime, and we'll find a new way of determining K, and I'll leave the algebra to you. If you combine these two equations together and solve for K, you get K is equal to a square root, because there's a square there, you get a square root of 1 plus V over C divided by 1 minus V over C. Okay? And that factor of K is a Doppler shift in exact, or 1 over K actually, is a Doppler shift in exactly the same way that we had the Doppler shift for sound in air. Okay, so this is called the relativistic Doppler shift. So I'm not going to talk about that because you have an exercise which will give you some examples and familiarity with working with this Doppler shift and see what the results are. But basically, if Bob is drifting away from Alice and she has a light signal, let's say a laser, say a green laser that she's shining toward Bob, if Bob is drifting away, she will see that laser light redshifted towards, like the frequency lowered, so redshifted, so it'll be the light will be redder. If Bob is moving toward Alice, he will see that green light is shifted towards the blue. Okay, so just like a siren coming toward or away from you, pitch higher, lower, same thing applies for light. But for light, it's the Doppler shift is slightly different. What I want you to notice about this Doppler shift is, in the case of the non-relativistic Doppler shift was this, 1 over 1 minus V over C. And for this guy, and so the Doppler shift, 1 over K, okay, this is getting messy, 1 over K is 1 minus V over C. Okay, so remember, for the non-relativistic Doppler shift, we could consider the possibility that Bob was moving supersonic, okay, moving at faster than the speed of sound. We could easily put into this equation a V greater than C, in which case he hears the thing backwards, right? Have we talked about that? Okay, what happens if we put a V bigger than C in this equation? You can't because?
Root negative.
But put a V bigger than C here, let's put a V equal 2 times C. Then I'll have a 1 minus 2 is negative 1, where the numerator will be positive. I'll have a negative number under the square root, and I will get an imaginary Doppler shift. So I can't have that. So right away, built into this Doppler shift is the idea that Bob can't be going faster than the speed of light. Okay, so et cetera. So there are exercises on this. So I want you to. I think you'll have a lot of fun doing those exercises. Okay, so let's just leave it at that, So sure, relativistic Doppler shift. This is very, very important. This is how we measure velocities of things, right? I mean, suppose I want to measure the velocity of a galaxy. Well, I can't go out there with a big meter stick and a clock and say, yes, this galaxy is moving across my meter stick at a certain rate, right? I mean, you've got to be more practical than that. And that, so what we do is we measure. So here's us over here, and here's this galaxy, and this galaxy is, say, drifting away from us. And so the light that's coming to us, we say it's emitted by excited atoms. So we know exactly the frequency of that light according to the atom itself. From the point of view of the atom is emitting light of a certain color, okay, of a certain frequency. But then because the galaxy is in motion with respect to us, we will see that exact frequency shifted down to a lower frequency. Okay? And by measuring the amount of shift, we can determine the recessional velocity of that galaxy with respect to us. It's an extremely important tool. Okay? And these velocities, the velocities of galaxies, become relativistic if they're far enough away. And so we actually need this relativistic formula instead of this guy. You can show that for small values of v, this is the same as this. Maybe that's an exercise for you to think about using the binomial approximation that Stefan told you about yesterday. If you use the binomial approximation, this is the same as that for small v over c. But anyways, I'll leave that to the problems. Right. The important thing about this k for us is that it tells us something very important about the nature of time. Okay, and we will see that. Like presently, yeah.
So like, if we were to measure the velocity at that beginning,
yep.
Wouldn't that like give us an incorrect answer if it's accelerating away?
If it's accelerating,
like, if the space itself is accelerating away from us, then wouldn't that answer not tell us anything?
Oh, do you mean if?
I mean, if the two points in space are like accelerating away from each other, like space itself is accelerating in expansion, right? So,
right.
So then, when we read that velocity that we get from the frequency, what is that telling us relative to the fact that we know that space
okay.
is...
So, right. Okay, so let me just make a clarification here. So when we say that, let me say it a little bit differently. So what's actually happening is something like this. So here's us, and here's this galaxy, and the space between us and this galaxy is expanding. Okay, and so when a photon is emitted over here, okay, and it's traveling through this space is expanding, and the photon gets stretched. Its wavelength gets longer. Okay, and so that's a redshift, which is the same kind of thing as this redshift.
Like, would you say?
Yeah, I would say that we can get the correct velocity.
Okay.
Yeah. I think those astronomers know what they're doing. Okay. So, good question. Okay. So let's look at the important thing here, which is time dilation. What does this tell us about the nature of time? What does this K tell us? Okay, so let's plug in some numbers here. How many want to see some numbers? Only one of you. Oh, great. Okay, so you guys are all like really hardcore theory, aren't you? Okay, so I want to see some numbers. Okay, so here we've got, okay, we're just going to draw the experiment again. So we're going to be making sure we've got CT here. So CTA, and Bob is drifting over here, CTB. And here is our experiment. Alice waits some time, and then she sends this light signal over. And when Bob receives that light signal, he is some distance d away from Alice. Okay, so let's put in some numbers here. There's some velocity v. Let's suppose that v is 4/5 the speed of light. Okay, so what that means is, how would I draw this line graphically? In this picture, well, what I would do is I would go 4 units to the right and 5 units up. So on my graph paper, whatever my graph paper is, I've got these little squares, I would go 4 units to the right, 5 units up, or 8 and 10 or whatever. OK, Okay, and that would give me this line, okay, which is slightly to the left of 45 degrees, slightly less than 45 degrees. He's moving subluminally, okay? But close to the speed of light. And let's suppose that Alice, so Bob drifts by Alice like this, crosses her path at this location. She waits a certain time on her watch before she clicks on her laser. And let's suppose that time is very small, 10 to the minus 8 seconds. Okay, so that tells us that c times this time, that's 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, times 10 to the minus 8 seconds is 3 meters. Okay, remember, space and time are measured in meters. Both are measured in meters. So this time ct here is 3 meters. That's actually this distance. Okay, that's so 3 meters, that just means how far does light travel in 10 to the minus 8 seconds? Well, just c times 10 to the minus 8 seconds, it'll travel 3 meters. Okay, that's the time on Alice's watch, okay, times c. Okay, and then she sends this guy out. This is 45, et cetera, et cetera. What else do we need here? Okay, also recall equation number 1 there. So d divided by ct is v over c minus 1 over v over c. So let me see. So what that tells us is that d is this thing times ct. Okay, so what's this? V over c is 4 fifths divided by 1 minus 4 fifths times ct. We figured out ct is 3 meters. So what is that?
Twelve.
Excellent. Okay, 12 meters. Just trying to wake up your algebra brains. Okay, and so then, and also k is this funny square root, 1 minus, sorry, is it 1 plus? Yeah, 1 plus v over c divided by 1 minus v over c. Okay, so that's the square root of 1 plus 4 fifths divided by 1 minus 4 fifths. So what's that? That was fast. So that's the square root of 9, which is 3. Okay? So that's what that k factor is. So what does that k factor mean? Well, it means that if Alice is sending light to Bob, so according to Alice, she's sending light at a certain frequency. Bob is drifting away from her at 80% speed of light, 4/5 c. Okay, he's going to measure that light at a lower frequency. How much lower? By a factor of 3. Okay? If she's sending light at 3,000 hertz or whatever, 3,000 times 10 to the whatever hertz, he'll measure it at 1,000 times 10 to the whatever hertz. Okay, so that's the redshift. Okay, and so now what can we do with all that? Well, now we can say, oh, okay, well, we know d is, we just figured that out, is 12 meters. So this distance is 12 meters, which means, so Alice waits 10 to the minus 8 seconds, clicks the laser on, it catches up with Bob when he has moved 12 meters away from Alice. Okay, and so if we know this is 12 meters, what's that? So this is also 12 meters. Okay, so what is that total time? So that total time is 15 meters. Oh, there they are. So 3 meters plus 12 meters is 15 meters. So it's 15 meters elapsed on Alice's clock. But how do we convert meters into elapsed time? So the time elapsed on Alice's clock, delta always means change. So the change in the time elapsed on Alice, or the time of Alice's clock, the elapsed time is 15 meters. And then what do I do? Divide by c. Okay, so what is that? C is 3 times 10 to the 8. So we've got a 3. 5. 15 over 3 is 5. A 10 to the 8 down here means a 10 to the minus 8 in the numerator. Seconds. So remember that Alice waited only one waited 10 to the minus 8 seconds, and the elapsed time, and then she sent that light signal out, it was reflected back, the total time is 5 times 10 to the minus 8, so 5 times as long. Okay, and also, what we want here is this guy here, KCT. That's the time elapsed for Bob. Okay, so that's the important one here. Okay, so let's work that out. So K times CT, we just figured out K, that Doppler shift is a factor of 3, and we figured out CT. CT is just 3 meters. So that's 9 meters. Okay, and that tells us that the time elapsed on Bob's clock from the moment that he crosses Alice's path to the moment that he receives the light signal from Alice is 9 meters divided by C, which is what? 3. Okay? So let's draw a picture of this. So here's Alice. Here's Bob. So just a simplified picture here. And let me see. The total time for Alice is 5. Let's just drop the 10 to the minus 8. The total time for Alice is 5. Okay, so she zeros her clock here. At 1, she emits the light signal, and then it comes back. 2, 3, 4, 5. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So the picture is like this. She emits the light signal, and it comes back. Okay, and for Bob, let's just get rid of that so it's not messy. For Bob, the elapsed time is 3. Okay, so he zeros his clock here, and it goes 1, 2, 3. Okay? So when Alice's clock reads 5, Bob's clock reads 3. 5 seconds have elapsed for Alice, or when 5 seconds have elapsed for Alice, only 3 seconds have elapsed for Bob. Okay? So this is a time dilation. There's no such thing as universal time. So the picture looks like this. When 1 second elapses for Alice, according to Newtonian time, if we just draw horizontal lines like this, this would correspond to 1 second elapsed for Bob. But from this picture, how much time is actually elapsed for Bob? Is it less or more than 1 second? What is it exactly? Sorry? 3/5. 3/5 of a second. Okay, so this is time dilation. Okay. So basically, the whole thing behind all of this is Einstein's attempt to put light on the same footing as matter. To put that's it. That's really all it is. Okay. To recognize that matter can have physical properties like momentum. Energy, angular momentum, and all that stuff, Maxwell's equations tell us that light has exactly the same properties. It has momentum, angular momentum, energy. It can carry all of these things as it moves through the vacuum of space. And so Einstein said, well, let's put the two of them on the same footing. That's all he really said. And when you do that, you discover that the only way you can do that is if there's are such things as time delay. Or one of the consequences of doing that is, or what is required is that you have this time dilation. Okay, so the idea of universal time is just broken here. Okay, so we realize that that's no longer the case. Okay, all right. So let's just do this in general. So here we plugged in some numbers. So let's just take 2 minutes here to make this general and come up with a general formula for time dilation. Okay, so one that you will. That many of you will have seen before. Okay, so in general, our picture is like this. CTA, CTB. That, and K times CT. And this is Alice's x-axis. This is space according to Alice, time according to Alice, time according to Bob, and all the usual stuff. So what we're going to do is just change notation here. Okay, we're going to recognize that there is a triangle here, and we're going to relabel the sides of the triangle. We're going to call this side over here, we're going to call it C times delta TA. This is the time elapsed for Alice times C, delta CA times C. Okay. This is the time here elapsed for Bob. We're going to call that C times delta TB times C. This is the distance that Bob moves in Alice's space. So that's the change, that's delta XA. Okay, so we have labeled our triangle with those three sides. And so we have delta XA, well, what is that? That's just D. We have C times delta TB, and what is that? That's just KCT. And C times delta TA is this plus this. Okay, so now you'll notice, and also we're going to use equation number one. Okay, so we've just changed our notation a little bit. Okay, and so what we find is, so what is delta TA? So delta TA, all I do is I take this right-hand side and divide by C. So that's T plus D over C. Okay. So that's T plus, what is D divided by C? D divided by C is what? This junk times capital T. And so how do I simplify this? What is the simplification of that? Sorry? YT? Oh, because we're taking D divided by C. So D divided by C is just this part of it. So we bring the T over to that side. So when I add this to this, how does it simplify? Factor out the T, and then what do I get? And what does this simplify to? Okay, so it simplifies to that. And so let's take the ratio. In physics, we're almost always just interested in the ratios. One time relative to another time and so on. Okay, so the ratio of delta TB, delta TB to A, the ratio of those two, let's see, what is delta TB? Delta TB is what? Just KT. I just cancel off the C's, right? That's just KT. And delta TA we have is 1 over 1 minus B over C times T. This T cancels out. Okay. So the result we're going to get is independent of how long Alice or Bob waits. Okay? It's just a universal result. It's a universal relationship between those two observers. Okay. And so what is K? Well, let's see, one over this, move to the numerator, becomes one minus V over C. So that's that part of it. And then we multiply by K. Well, what was K? K was one plus V over C divided by one minus V over C square root. Okay, so how does this simplify?
How would I simplify that?
So you end up with the root of 1 plus V over C over 1 minus V. Well, yeah.
So here I have an object and the square root of an object. So this is really the square root of 1 minus V over C times the square root of 1 plus V over C. Okay, and so if I bring both of these things together under the square root sign, you know, A minus B times A plus B is A squared minus B squared. So I get a 1 minus the square. Okay, so the ratio of the two times is this. So at the end of the day, our final result is Oops, sorry. Okay, so our final result then is this. Just getting rid of the C, just to make it a bit simpler. In any situation like this, where you have, say, Alice, we consider her to be at rest, who we consider to be at rest, and Bob drifting with some velocity V relative to Alice, what we have is Alice's clock looks something like this, tick, 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 tick. Time is ticking away like this. Bob's clock relative to Alice's in this picture is ticking more slowly. So the picture looks something like that. Okay, and if we compare carefully, if we look at this interval of time, delta TA, so when a time delta TA elapses for Alice, a certain time elapses for Bob. And we find that the amount of time elapsed for Bob, given that ratio there, is just the square root of 1 minus b squared over c squared times the time elapsed for Alice. Okay, so that's a general formula for time dilation. And if we were to stick in V over C equals 4/5, what is this thing? What is that square root? What is it? Okay, so there's a square root of 1 minus 16 over 25. Is the square root of 9 over 25? Is 3 over 5. Okay, so let's see if this works. If we take 3 over 5, so in our previous picture, we had this. What did we have? What did we have on here? 15 and 9 here, right? So let's see if that works. If I take 3/5 times delta TA is 15 here. What's 3/5 of 15? 9. Okay, that's 9. That's that 9 over there. Okay, so time is not universal. Okay. Time depends upon the observer. All right, so next time we'll talk about geometry of space-time. Okay, so let's take a break. That was a long, I've been torturing you guys. Yeah, we're done. We're out of here. All right, bistro, food.